Blog Talk Radio.
I'm looking for you. Yep, today's show is being aired, having been previously recorded. We're going to start with a feature here on how best to use radar antennas. And after today's interview, I will announce the winner of a free pocket radar pulled on after the playing of the UR Tennis Network waiver. So we're going to talk a little bit about having good uses of radar right now. Here we go. This segment is brought to you by Pocket Radar, and we're here talking with Ken DeHart, and he's going to explain a little bit about how he uses the Pocket Radar to enhance the learning of his students. Ken?
Bill, the Pocket Radar has been like the easiest radar gun I've ever had to use. Had radar guns where they've had a thing set at the net with measure speed, and we hit that and break it a few times, pointing a radar gun, and the batteries would go dead. With the pocket radar, it's about the size of a cell phone, and it's so easy to use. You just point it, you press the red button, and it records it. And it's simple because I can have the kids use it instead of me having to use it all the time, which allows me to be free to roam around and do other things with it. And it's so simple to read. In fact, it'll measure how fast someone is running, as well as how fast they're hitting a ball. And we do it not only for the serve, we can actually measure ground stroke speed and volley speed. So what we tend to do a lot in my classes, we'll say, look, we're hitting at level two. Level two for you should be a 45-mile-an-hour ground stroke. Or level three should be like a 65-mile-an-hour ground stroke. We actually talk to the kids about the speed they actually hit the ball at and measure that speed. So when they hit it, they get a feel for how fast they should swing racket head speed-wise. It's hard to understand what they're doing with the ball better, too, by measuring the speed of the ball. Pretty much, you know, if you'd stand behind the server and aim it at the spot where you see the ball's going to come out of like that again, it works. There's not, you know, you can be a little bit off-center. You don't have to be right on it. You can also measure the serve from a little bit more from the front. Same with the ground strokes. You can measure them from head-on or from behind. It's what's really neat about this, it doesn't have to be an exact science like it used to be with the old radar guns. You had to get it right, and usually you got the racket head speed and not the ball speed. Pocket radar doesn't have it at all, and it's got a great long life battery operation. It doesn't require recharging and resetting all the time either, which is great for us because usually we got to pick it up and use it, and oh, I forgot to charge it. And it's not like that with the pocket radar. People get deceived. Like a lot of our juniors think they're serving at 120 miles an hour, and they see it like 60 miles an hour. I said, right, now if you want to increase your speed, you have to learn to relax more, because the looser you are, the faster you can increase racket head speed. And we can tell when they start to tense up, because they actually lose speed. So, you know, you're saying you're getting too tight. Well, what does it mean to the student? Well, if I measure it, your ball speed has gone down. As you start to loosen up again, you'll see you'll increase your ball speed. So it's an easy way to help them understand tension as far as related to speed and more of a natural athletic motion. So most people try to tense up to hit harder. And we know when you're too tight, you're too tense. When you're too tense, you're done. You're past history. You've got to stay loose to play well.
Thanks for coming on, Ken, to talk about the pocket radar. And for those of you who are interested in this, you can send an email to info@pocketradar.com. Or you can get more information on the internet at pocketradar.com. And then also, if you're a U.S. customer, you can call in at 1-888-381-2672. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you, Bill.
Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Hello, hello, and welcome to Infinite Tennis. I'm your host, Bill Patton, and I'm excited today because I have a guest coming on today who we've been talking for a few weeks about getting him on. He's been traveling a lot. He's one of the, you know, the best coaches in the world, in my estimation. Also a friendly guy, very willing to share his ideas. And we're going to bring him out here. His name is Dr. Martin Baroque. He is originally from the Czech Republic, coaching currently in Switzerland. And I hope we get a better connection. We were talking earlier. We were Skyping a little bit. Hopefully this is a better connection. But we're going to go right to a commercial, come right out, bring Martin on the show, and hopefully that goes really well. All right, here we go.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
Okay, welcome back, everybody. And hello, Martin, are you there?
Hello, Bill. Here I am from Switzerland.
All right, excellent. And I think that we do have a better connection, so that's excellent. All right.
Sounds so good to me.
How are you doing today, Martin?
Well, doing quite okay. Have been home for a few days now from a longer trip with some junior player around Europe. And looking forward to have a nice talk with you about some interesting issues of the tennis world.
Excellent. So, tell us about you and what and your background. How did you get started playing tennis, and how far did you go with that?
Look, Bill, I started tennis seriously when I was 16. I became a member in Prague in a very famous club, Slavia, which is a club, which used to be a club, having a couple guys playing in top 100 in the world, ATP tennis. And I came there more or less as a beginner, which had a dream to become a great player. And I didn't have, let's say, any material support, any knowledge support. So I was just watching a lot, what I saw around. I bought all different books. I was practicing against the wall hours every day. And obviously, this is not enough. But after a certain time, I learned a lot about the game. And when I played with somebody, I was giving people some advices, or players some advices, and they kind of liked that. And in one moment, when I was like between 18 and 19, I was more interested in helping to the others than working on my game. So I guess that's this is how I became coach.
Yeah, you know, I'm reflecting on the start of my career as a coach and how it feels very similar because I felt like I had to fake it at first, and I was surprised when people were learning. But it sounds like you were more or less were self-taught, and then you took what you learned from having experimented.
Well, you know, I was self-taught, and I was lucky enough that at the time, and we are talking about the 80s here in Czechoslovakia, I have been probably back then the best tennis books available, you know, with the knowledge about technique and training. And I was able to observe practices of people like Tomáš Šmíd, Pavel Složil, you know, famous players, all Davis Cup preparations of the Czechoslovak Davis Cup team have been happening in the indoor facility of my club. So I was fortunate to have seen a lot. And then in the 90s, when communism broke down and, you know, we got the chance to travel, I really wanted to learn a lot from other people. And I came in 1990 for the first time to the U.S. And I joined the back then USPTR. And I met people like Dennis van der Meer, and later on, Vic Braden joined USPTA, was influenced by people like Jack Grapple, Jim Lehr. And on the other side, you know, I became, let's say, quite friendly with a lot of people around the world from Europe as well. And you start to talk. I got my degree from Medical University in Prague. I'm actually MD by degree. And later on, I studied as my second degree coaching at the university. So I was fortunate enough to meet a lot of people, get a lot of inputs, and have been able to kind of make a fusion of these knowledge inputs into the one which I think is my leading line, my teaching.
Those people that you're mentioning are definitely pillars of American tennis. And, you know, I know that there's a notion going around that I reject, but there's a notion going around that somehow part of the problem of American tennis is that there aren't enough good coaches in America.
You know, this is one thing I would not agree with. When you look around, who is available, who lives in the U.S., some of the people with the best knowledge about tennis live in the United States. Some of them are obviously Americans, some foreigners.
Yeah.
But the question is, and this is the same question not in America only, it's in many other countries as well, that today, unfortunately, knowledge and honesty doesn't make you to a friend of the people in power. Because people in power in soccer, in tennis, in politics, they want to kind of control their grip on power. And when they get involved with somebody who tries to find mistake, find improvements, these people are enemies for them. So people who are trying to improve things are actually often, unfortunately, not welcome.
Yeah, I agree with you that it's very unfortunate when people who are in positions where they can actually help quite a few people end up because of their own ego-driven agenda, you know, go about doing things that are self-serving or serving to the people that are in their little group instead of looking at the big picture and what's the greatest good for everyone.
Exactly. So, I'll give you one. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Okay, I'll give you one small example, Bill. Back, I guess it was 2006, I was back then working with one Czech player, with Hanna Šramová. I met her here in Switzerland at one tournament. She was 25, 26. I admired her fighting spirit. She was out of top 200 in the world. And I helped her a little bit. She got with me into top 100 in 2006. I guess she was in all first rounds of the Grand Slams, which was, you know, the biggest result of her career. And when I was in New York, we've had the U.S. Open. Father of Vanya King saw some of our practices, and he came to me, asked me for some help. And I did some little help. I don't want to go too deep into it with Vanya King and her father, with David. And we brought Vanya when she was 18 to top 50 in the world. Vanya finished year, I guess it was 2006, at position number 50 WTA. She won tournament in Bangkok. We've been doing some coaching, at the tournament over the internet and everything. And, well, okay, it worked. And the USTA badly wanted her to be in their player development program. And they've been pushing so hard, going, between the parents, you have to let Vanya go, saying to the mother, to the USTA. Then USTA got her. And 1 year from that, she was out of top 100. And kind of from that on, I am not being considered friend by a lot of people in the U.S. because, they want, let's say, programs like player development programs, they want to say the best players are with us because they want to justify their positions, their facilities, their salaries, and so on, so on.
Yeah, I think there's truth to that, and yet I want to steer the conversation more into the expertise. So I think there have been a lot of comments that are similar to that that have been coming up. So I do appreciate you sharing that, but let's kind of shift more into you as a coach and what's your approach. I mean, because would you say that you are more of a scientist or an artist when you're coaching?
Look, this is a good question, Bill. And for me, coaching is a combination of both. And every coach is, it's an art to be a coach. But when you have some scientific background, then you might have a chance to be more successful in the art of coaching. And for me, what I try in all my career, I try to make difficult things easy, to try to put the science, to translate it into the easy ways how to use it, that everybody can use it to improve their game.
Yeah, I think that's very important, because then you can build step by step from one thing to the next, as long as each step is very manageable. So that's great advice for any coach, any parent who'd like to coach their kid is to develop that simplicity.
Go ahead. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, let me finish my point there. Because one of the most common things that I see when I adopt a player who's been coached or has been self-taught is I see so many players who are, in trying to mimic someone else, creating much more complicated strokes than what is going to be effective.
Exactly. And this is one of the issues which makes tennis difficult. In general, when you look at the game of the best players, the stroke production of the most dominant players is mostly the most easy one, very simple one. And the more motions you add to any stroke, the more potential problems you are creating. And for me, the key issue in developing a player and from early on is how you integrate the activity of the body into the stroke. And this is what I see around the world, in the U.S., in Europe, wherever you go, that a lot of people today teach, or a lot of coaches, unfortunately, systems, let the kids use just the hands. That the kids learn in the beginning the strokes using their hands. They don't use the body as much. And
yeah,
then later on, you can be very successful when you are talented, when you have good coordination skills, and when you are fast. You can be very successful using the arms as a dominant source for the power in the strokes until junior tennis. But when you get into the professional tennis using their arms, you can't be very successful. And this is what you can see when you look at the top juniors. You have gallery when you go to Wimbledon. There you have a gallery of all the juniors who won, let's say, the junior Wimbledon. And then you see that approximately one half of them was quite successful in professional game later on. And some of them, like Ivan Lendl, Roger Federer, extremely successful. Stefan Edberg, obviously. Yep. And then you have people, let's say I give one Swiss example here, Roman Wallant, who won Wimbledon as well, and he never made it into top 300 even in the world. And this is for me the decision. If the player is keen on using the body in the strokes or not. The ones who use the arms as the dominant source of power, they come in one moment, they come to a ceiling which they can't break through.
Yeah, that's a great observation, and let's get more into that in a moment. I have some other questions to draw that out more, but we're going to have a commercial really quick, and then when we come back, then I'll kind of share some of the things that I learned from you when you gave your talk here in Northern California at Stanford University. But let's do the commercial, and then we'll come back to that.
This is Jason Haynes, CEO of the UR Tennis Network. We are proud to announce the 2013 summer camp season has begun. At ussportcamps.com, you can plan out a Nike tennis camp experience. These are offered to both adults and juniors for day and overnight camps. Visit ussportcamps.com to pick up a brochure and join over 50,000 youth who say yes to our summer camp experience. Join a Nike tennis camp at www.ussportcamps.com or call us at 1-800-NIKE-CAMPS. In 2013, let our summer camps be your victory. Choose the Nike tennis camps and take your game to the next level.
Okay, so we're back, and Martin, I loved it when you came to Northern California and you did a four-hour specialty course at the USPTA division convention that we had there. And in fact, and then you were teaching the serve and you showed us 1,000 pictures of this player, good player, because they do this. This player, only 850 in the world, no good, you know. And do you remember that? Do you remember showing all those pictures?
Of course I do. You know, I've done talk about the serve a couple of times, but one of the ones which I really enjoyed was the one at Stanford University, obviously, with very nice group of people watching this seminar.
And the thing I remember is that you know, when you were teaching the serve and getting the entire upper arm rotation forward, and then I asked you if you would show me in front of everybody, and then you twisted my arm, and it hurt pretty bad, but I got the point. So if you could explain a little bit more about that, and then also, you know, I remember the tossing of the volleyballs. So can you get into how you train people initially in using their body?
Okay. I start with the first thing, and then we come to the serve. We start actually every tennis session with players at any level with throwing. Today we use foam balls with coating. We used to use basketball with not so hard inflated basketball in the past. Now we use coated foam ball, and we throw the ball with open stance on both sides, forehand open stance, backhand open stance, and with pushing off the ground, switching the shoulders, that the players get warmed up all or the entire body muscles the way they should be using them later on the tennis court. So we start with the big muscle groups right from the beginning. A lot of people start when they go to the court just some strokes with the forearm, and then later on they might integrate the body more and more. My approach is to start with the mobilization of the big body muscle groups right from the beginning. And this is why I use this big ball.
It's like when you're packing the car, you have to put the big items in first, and then you put the medium-sized items in, and then you have room for the little stuff. And so
exactly.
I think that so I think the analogy holds when building tennis strokes. You want to start with the biggest body parts moving and then move towards the smaller, yeah?
You know, and the fun thing is I developed this actually by case. back in 1987, 89, I was conditioning coach of Peter Korda, who later on became number two in the world. And Peter was a huge talent, but he was not so keen on doing some conditioning. And I needed to find, you know, something to make it fun for him to do some conditioning, to develop some dynamic power and everything. So I started a game with him that we have been throwing medicine balls at each other. And, you know, this was actually the beginning of this exercise. And through throwing these medicine balls, you know, trying to kind of kill each other with the medicine balls, he improved his dynamic power so much that later on I said, wow, this is a great thing, not only for Peter, we can use it for everybody. But this was the beginning how actually this started. But you asked me about the surf, and I have to say surf is maybe my most favorite stroke for teaching. And I tell you why. First of all, when I was playing myself, I didn't have any coach. I had just few lessons in my life. I learned surf completely wrong. And I had struggles for years before I got the understanding of the surf. And one of the crucial elements for me was when I came to Hilton Head, to the USPTR, and I learned much more about the effect of pronation and how to teach pronation from Dennis van der Meer.
Yeah.
This was one important element for me because pronation was not taught much in the, you know, process of teaching the surf anywhere. And when you look into almost any tennis learning book, there is one essential wrong statement almost in any of these books. They tell you, you go with your arm up, you strike the ball, and you pull your arm down to your left leg, talking about right-handed player in this case, obviously here. And I think this is the biggest misconception. When the players try to hit the ball and get as fast as possible to the left leg. Because while doing this, you are necessarily limiting the pronation and the body involvement around the impact. And for me, the most important element of a good serve is that the pronation, which we are talking about turning the arm from the outside, inside to the outside, that your palm of your striking hand is facing to the outside, away from you, then this is happening at very high position, which means with the elbow high above the shoulder. At the same time, while pronating, the palm of your striking hand facing to the outside. And this must be, in the thinking of the player, the dominant information. And not, I have to come to the left leg. When you come to the left leg as a relaxation, that's fine. That's not a problem. But this is not your task in the striking. In the striking, the task must be elbow high, get the center of gravity as high as possible, and pronate as efficiently as possible with your body that the palm of your striking hand goes down and outside. And when you look at some of the best servers in the history, let's say Boris Becker, or in the female side, Steffi Graf, they've been absolutely dominant number ones in the world, and they never, ever would go with the racket on the serve to the left leg. They've been staying on the right until the end of the stroke.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So that's I appreciate the very detailed explanation. And, you know, the interesting thing to me was that I always heard about pronation, but when you came and detailed it and then also helped me by actually putting my arm all the way in that position, it made me realize how much of a whole body experience that is to get your upper arm to completely rotate, because it's going to affect your shoulder.
Exactly.
And I also noticed that for myself and my students that much greater shoulder flexibility was necessary. So it began, so it challenged us to then become more flexible in order to allow that to happen pain-free.
Absolutely.
So,
you know, it's very complex activity, the surf, and we are just touching the key elements. But generally, when we go around the world, most of the people who teach surf and who try to surf, they are not keen of the pronation. They don't understand the pronation. And then you have another smaller group which knows a little bit about the pronation, but they see the pronation purely as the activity of the wrist and the forearm. And then you have very, very small group of great surfers who understood that the real pronation is not activity of the forearm and wrist, mainly, but it's mainly the axis work from the entire upper limb and involvement of the entire body weight in this action. And when you see the best surfers in the history, and for me, I would name maybe three people here, and I would name Bill Tilden, I would name Boris Becker, and I would name Pete Sampras. You see very clear...
How about Pancho Gonzalez? Because I've looked at his book from the 50s and seen that,
exactly.
And I thought that his serve holds up to today's standards without a doubt.
Exactly. Great, great remark. You are absolutely right. I'm using Pancho Gonzalez's pictures as well when I do my seminars. I guess I showed it at Stanford too. And you see, this is very clear, dominant information what they are trying to fulfill the task of the pronation from the entire body and not rushing the racket to the left leg.
Okay, so let's move to another subject. You know, congratulations to the Czech Republic for sweeping the Fed Cup and the Davis Cup. Did you get to have a hand in helping out any of those players during that time?
Actually, directly, I didn't work with any of these players who won in the 2012 the Fed Cup and the Davis Cup for Czech Republic. But, you know, I've been in 1992, I started the first private coaches education in Eastern Europe back then. And I guess I influenced with my information and my seminars for coaches quite few people in the Czech Republic who have to do with the players who are members of the team. For example, David Kotyza, who is the coach of Petra Kvitova. He was studying actually at the university with me, and he came to some of my education. And a lot of the other coaches obviously came to my seminars, read my articles, which I was writing in Czech tennis magazine. So I would say my input is from this side. And then I have over the years done some work back then with Peter Korda, and Peter was over years coach of Radek Štěpánek, so we have maybe some connection on this level too.
Yeah, actually, you're aware that Radek Štěpánek is actually a little bit of a fan favorite out here because he came out in a Sharks hockey uniform for the final of the SAP Open in San Jose, and he did the worm on the court, so that was fun. So tell us a little bit about some of the players who are on the ATP Tour or the WTA Tour that you've been working with lately, and if you can, you know, share with us some of the things that you've helped them with, and so.
Well, let's say, players which are in the spotlight. In the last years, I worked a little bit with Sloane Stephens, and I think Sloane is an enormous talent, and she has, for me, potential to go all the way. And with Sloane, back in 2010 and 11, I first worked with her on the surf, and it was, for me, a remarkable experience. We have done some cooperation with Nick Saviano, who was overseeing Sloane's career since her childhood. And I was back then in Florida. And we have been on the court with Sloane. Sloane had some trouble to surf. And when I explained her to surf the way like I explained it to you, she was able to make it really perfectly on the second attempt.
But wow.
I never, ever saw something like that in my life. And then later on, we worked on her surf, and I think I was able to help her to develop, on her forehand, first on the serve, then the forehand, and I guess I was able to help her develop this powerful forehand she has. And then in 2011, I spent some time with her, and then we've been working on the backhand as well. And I would say we didn't finish our work. And, you know, in this world, the things are getting at a certain moment very complicated because there are a lot of influences. And when the players come close to the top, then there's a lot of people want to talk into it and be involved. And sometimes approach when somebody likes to just do solid work and sees the long-term perspective, it's not always what is, let's say.
I think there's a lesson there for parents. I mean, I think there's a lesson there for parents and for players to take a more steady approach. One thing I advocate, actually, there are two things I'd like to make a point out of, because one, when you were talking about how the second try, she did it almost perfectly. When I'm looking at talent, I don't necessarily look at how fast can someone run or how strong are they or whatnot. I think it's remarkable when you find someone who has body awareness that they can take your instruction and they can put it into action very early. I call them one-timers, because you tell them one time and then they approximate it, and then it's just a matter of them perfecting it in a short while. The other thing is, you know, back to this point about the about, you know, kind of a scatterbrained approach to coaching and having too many voices, I think it's wise. Actually, let me ask you this. Do you think it's wise for people to have a, quote, head coach who is the one who disseminates the information? You might have experts come in, but the one coach is the one who is the guardian of all that.
Look, this is a very complex question, and I can't say yes or no to it, because it always goes down to the people. And some people might work together, some people might not work together. But generally, for me, it's very important that you have a connection between the player and the one coach, the one who kind of has the plan. Because as we talked about it in the beginning, it's science and it's art. And like an artist knows how the painting or the architectural sculpture, whatever, should look like, the artist as a coach has a vision how he or she would like to mold the player.
Yes.
And when you can meet on halfway with the player and kind of come to the situation that after certain moments together, certain time together, you say A and then the player can say B, you are in the situation in which you wish to be. And this is not happening that often that you are in that. And there are often situations that a lot of people want to get involved and a lot of people hope for some quick fixes. And when you have too many people talking, this interconnection on the brain level is often being disturbed.
You know, yeah, and it comes back to the saying that a racehorse built by committee is a camel. And
yes.
I believe that horses are still faster than camels, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure the real fact on that. But the idea is, you get a committee of people together, and you're going to build something, and it's not going to be quite as pretty. So that's a really great comment from you. And you know, let's take a look what we have next. What do you think of the whole transition ball experience of using the compression balls? How is that helpful, and how can that hurt a player's development?
Look, this is, again, not so easy question. It's not that you can say something is white or black. This is a combination. And in general, transition balls being out there, I think it's a great tool. Myself, I don't use them. Instead of using the compression balls or the red, orange and yellow ball, green ball, sorry, green dot ball. I am using foam balls because foam balls for me have the same, give the same opportunity that they are bouncing lower, giving more time to the player to, you know, have time to prepare for the shot, for the stroke. But because of the air resistance, the foam balls, they demand from the players to use the entire body to strike the ball. When you are using the low compression balls, which are also very light, you can still strike them often, and especially when the instruction is not very, let's say, exact, you can strike them just using the arm, which is for me the danger aspect. Because when kids learn to use the arms as a main source of power, they will have problems later most of the time. And on the other, on the other side, what I see is the biggest issue here is the mandate. I understand that there is some interest to put mandate because when the mandate will be not out there, many people might be not using balls like that. But we have the issue that when you take, as example, a child who is growing up, you know, born child, and children normally start to walk around the age of 12 months. You have some children which might start to walk when they are 9 or 10 months old. And you also can't come and say, come on, fellow, you can't walk now. You have to keep, you know, sitting on your butt until you are 12 months old. And the same we have in tennis. You know, it's some players, and especially in the, you know, age groups like under 10, under 12, under 14, the biological developments are so diverse from the calendar age of the players. And I see it as very difficult when somebody in the office says, under 10, you have to do this, nothing else. I think the only person being able to decide what my player and what the player should best do is the coach, because he's the only one educated and in touch with the player to say this player, maybe even in the age of 12, still might be needing the orange or green dot compression ball, and maybe the other player something else on one side. And on the other side, you know, I use in most of the practices diversity of balls. We start with small foam ball, you know, of perimeter of 9 centimeters, then we go to the 12 centimeter foam ball, then we go to the standard balls. And that you, through the progress, you know, through the practice, you have to progress and adjust it from your quality. And I'm saying, at this age, this ball, at this age, this ball, this is kind of not lucky solution in my understanding.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, I built a program for juniors that used progression balls, and we started from scratch, and we had 3 classes with the red balls, and then and 1 with the orange, and then the next session, then we had 2 red ball classes, 2 orange ball classes, and a green ball class. And within a few months, then we only had 1 red ball class. We had 3 different levels of orange ball. We had a fully dedicated green ball class and a yellow ball combined. But what my team of coaches did, we decided that when a player showed that they maintained the integrity of their strokes while competing, then they were ready for the next level. Because to me, the issue is proven mastery of technique while in a competitive situation. Because I think, as coaches, we know that kids will resort to whatever they need to if they're so focused on winning or losing that they'll throw their technique right out the window.
Yes, you know, I agree with you. And this is, for me, the main aspect that the coach must be the one who decides which player needs what at the given moment. And nobody in the office can make the decision and be more successful with that. When you talk about business, about making more people play, about making it business friendly, maybe this mandate is a good thing. When you want to develop good players, then I don't think it's the optimal approach. And, you know, in the States, a lot of people get a little bit the wrong information. A lot of people in the States are saying that in Europe, everybody is using it. And I tell you straight, that's not true. We have here in Europe these low compression balls. Some federations are pushing it more. Some federations in some countries less. But
right.
Private coaches almost don't use them. They, in the UK, association has a lot of money. They push, you know, for the use of these balls. In France, they do it. In Belgium, they do it. But what you see today, a lot of players coming to the top levels of the game don't come from these countries. You see players coming from Russia, Czech Republic, Slovakia, Belarus. All
right.
of these players don't use these balls. And they are ending, you know, in the top. So
yeah.
something in
yeah.
this entire construction is a little bit misleading.
Well, you know, I think you make a great point, and one thing that I've always loved is one aspect of the Spanish system where they take kids who are 13, 14, 15 years old, and they will have them play a low-level pro event, and they know that the kid is going to lose 6-0, 6-0, and he might not win a point. But what they're doing is they're showing him or her what is it going to take, and then that player has a decision to make. So I believe more that kids are resilient and they rise to the challenge more so than that they need to be coddled and helped along at every turn. Now, on the other hand, you know, some kids don't, you know, they love the game and they want to play tennis and they want to maybe play high school tennis, but they just don't have quite the same level of talent. Yes, the transition balls will help them become fine high school tennis players, and they should. So, but to think that it's a player development model, I'm just not really buying it, because you want those kids to play with the yellow balls about as soon as you can.
You know,
so.
General, I come back to what I said before. You have to, as a coach, to decide. And you have to be guiding the player at the most efficient way to control his or her game. And I give you one statement here. Martina Hingis, of Czech and Slovak origin, who played for Switzerland, former number one, I guess you know who I'm talking about, she now lately became a coach of Russian player Anastasia Pavlyuchenkova. And a few weeks ago, there was an interview here in one Swiss newspaper with Martina Hingis about her current activities as a coach. And the journalist tells her, Martina Hingis, you have had developed a great technique with your mother so you could, you know, be very successful. And Hingis answered, my mother taught me discipline and control. And this is for me the key issue, because today you have a lot of programs. They just want to have as many kids as possible, and they are not demanding enough. And when I say not demanding enough, I mean about the quality. Kids strike the ball flies without control somewhere, and everybody says, oh, great. For me, it's not great. For me, the greatness in tennis is not hitting the ball, hitting it as hard as you can. For me, controlling the situation, controlling the game is the greatness. And we don't see this happening too much. And I just developed a system which I'm kind of now trying to figure out how to market it. But in general, for me, majority of systems put the seed of difficult or future difficulty into the game right in the beginning of the children's career, because they let them use the hands and do everything with the hands without getting the proper body set up right from the beginning. And somebody might come in and say, look, the transition balls help for that, to get the body right. And I can answer you, yes, when you have good coach with the kids and transition balls, you can eventually learn the proper body, or teach, excuse me, the proper body use. But then you have situations which are being marketed like 16 kids on the court with one coach, you can't develop the game style with using the body properly. Or even,
that,
you know, one coach, eight.
Because and I'll sum it up this way. The transition balls don't teach anyone how to play, do they?
You know, they help you that you have more time. So you are less under stress. You have maybe more time to do the right technique. But, as you stated correctly, they don't teach you how to play correctly.
Absolutely. So, all right. So now let's shift gears again. What, you know, and I think you've already kind of alluded to your answers a little bit already, but let's say there's a parent or a player out there and they're going through the junior tennis experience and they want to have, and their goal is to become an elite player. They would like to be a pro or really a top Division I level college player. What would you advise them to do as they move forward through their juniors and seek training and whatnot?
Look, I would say the main thing is to look with future outlook at the game, not looking how many great results you are doing when you are 10, 11, 12. Obviously, you want to control the game. You want to have success, but not at any cost. Which, what I mean with that, the main thing is to learn the kid or teach the kid from the beginning to use the body in the strokes and to play the game which has future potential. So for me, future potential means using the body in the strokes, using the regulation of the body as the first aspect, and using the hands as little as possible, not correct the mistakes of the positioning with the hands too often. This is, for me, very important. And then what's important that they need to focus on controlling the ball, how they place the ball into the court. Because when you learn the placements, then you have the chance to become successful. Because what the better players do differently than the less great players on the tour, the best players maybe sometimes hit even slower balls, but they come much closer to the lines, mainly to the sidelines. And for that, you have to have the technical capacity to control the ball with the margin which gives you the chance to come so close to the lines. This would be one of my crucial advices.
All right. Well, I think that makes it a wrap. I mean, I think that I really appreciate you coming on the show here, and it's been great to talk with you. And, you know, folks, if you had any trouble hearing, I mean, it might be good to make sure that you play this again and maybe do it in a quiet room or with some headphones on, because I know I was able to hear you just fine, Martin, but with maybe a little bit of straining because the connection was better but not quite perfect. But thanks for coming out, coming on to the show, and I hope that you'll be coming by Northern California again sometime soon. It was great to see you there in Monterey as well. So thank you.
Well,
and
it was my pleasure to talk with you, and I think we did connect very well on some important points of the game. And, you know, I really appreciate your smart approach and your, you know, ability to see where the problems of the game are today.
Yes. And, before we sign out here, I would like to see how people can contact you, because, you know, there might be some people that might want to come get their fix serve fixed or you know, get completely.
You can sure
how can people,
and anybody interested can contact me at my email address mgb@mgbsports.org, or they can also for free sign up at my Tennis Network, www.mytennisworld.net, which is a tennis network showing a lot of images, technical images of the strokes of the best players in the world, explaining a couple of the crucial elements of the proper technique. And they can, you know, contact me also over the network. Everybody who wants to become a member has to sign up. I have to agree that he can enter the network. It's for free otherwise. This is the other way how they can contact me.
Okay, I'm going to read that back really quick. So it's mgb@mgbsports.org.
This is my email address, correct, where I can be reached?
Yeah. Okay. All right, very good. Have a great evening there in Switzerland.
Bill, thank you very much. Have a nice afternoon in California, and I look forward to meeting with you very soon at some of the great tennis events in the U.S.
All right, take care.
You too. Thank you, Bill. Bye now. And
bye-bye.
Good luck to everybody.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.
Okay, that's great. Oh, I'm ending the episode.
Okay.
Yeah, I had forgotten about that. That's kind of like Ferris Bueller stuff right there at the end of the credits where he's wondering if you're still... Are you still here? Are you still here? Okay, so as promised, I'm going to announce the winner of the Pocket Radar. And drum roll, please. Andy Slezak. Andy, please contact me with your shipping information, and I will send it out to you today. All right, and thanks for listening to the show. Next Saturday, I'll have a new show with Ken DeHart. A lot of you have listened to the first show, and we're going to go a little more deeply into the traits of top players, the mental game, doubles, and some really detailed stuff. So I really appreciate Ken and his availability to me personally and as someone who likes to share. And also remember, I'm available in the 510 and the 925 area codes for lessons, stringing, and, of course, life coaching. All right. So make sure you listen to all the shows. Thank you, those of you who've listened to past shows of mine, and I hope that you definitely will check out all the shows on the UR Tennis Network. And so now I'm going to leave you with this. Bear with me a moment. You tell me if you like this as an introduction or if you like the other one better, the first one.